Hey everybody, welcome back to the big idea of this week's conversation around the power of negative self-talk. T-Free and K-Dub here. We're excited to dive deep with you. We're going to talk about how much more impactful that negative self-talk is. We're going to talk about three different ways to break us from those thought patterns. We're going to go on a couple of rants like we always do, so get ready to enjoy some of those. And I'm going to finish up with story time, talking about some of my experiences with some stacking the negative and how that can become an issue, especially over years. And then when you do see stacking occur, try after, two negative events, get back to neutral as quick as possible. So excited to have you on this one with us, and let's get to it.
He's coming to you live from Bowling Green, Kentucky, with the same energy of all four of his golden retrievers wrapped up in one body. He's got 7 years teaching math, 3 years working with Challenge Day, been tutoring one-on-one throughout, my best friend and an awesome teacher, T-Free.
What's up, everybody? K-Dub's coming to you live from the Pacific Northwest. I don't know if I've actually seen you rock a whistle around your neck, but I'm challenging you next week to do it. The earphones almost bring the persona out. But he's got 11 years of teaching at middle school and high school social studies, 20 plus years coaching every sport anybody's ever thought of or created, including spike ball, I believe. My best friend, K-Dub.
Thank you for the intro. Did not coach spike ball, but I did run the club that the kids were using to play. What a weird game.
I threw that one out as a long shot, and it still landed.
Well, Pacific Northwest, spike ball is going to land. Thanks for listening, everyone, to Little Things or Big Things Education, brought to you by Peak Stake Mathematics. Don't forget to rate and review us. We'd love to hear from you at littlebiged.com. Give us those 5 stars. We're quite certain that we're beginning to earn them. And if we're not, we'll take the grade inflation. T-Free, what's on the schedule for today?
Hey, we are going big idea on the power of negative self-talk. And this is something that I've watched a handful of videos on. I'm very big on like the self-help, self-improvement, like the positive self-talk kind of vibe. But a few of the things I've seen on negative self-talk are just like eye-opening for me. And I was like, wow, like we need to shift it from the power of self-talk to the power of negative self-talk. And how much of a shift towards avoiding that is going to be massively important. And even just staying neutral is so much more beneficial than having like any sort of negative self-talk. Like even if we don't have an ounce of positive, if we can just stay neutral, like that's a massive win for us and our students. So excited to dive deep into that and talk about it. So that's kind of the game plan.
Sweet. I love it.
What's been your experience in your classroom with some of your students? Do you feel that usually when your students are crumbling, it's because they have a lack of positive self-talk or because they are full-fledged negative self-talking?
No, that's a really good way of like reframing the thought process on it, because you're right. The breakdowns or the failure to launch comes from the negative self-talk, right? Like the kids who have positive self-talk, like I feel like that's how you go from 85 to 95 or 90 to 100. But the going from 0 to 85, right, that chunk that most of us have the hardest time getting through, is definitely the kids with the self-talk and how damaging it is to their psychology.
Right. I mean, I definitely teach in one of those subjects that is just like, it's okay to say I suck at math all the time. And to overcome that barrier literally is probably the difference between passing and failing. Like if you can get beyond the I'm no good at math concept, you now have a chance at passing the math class.
I'm just going to cite the connection activity or conversation we had last week where I talked about my favorite math teacher other than Mr. Whitmore being the one who told me to go ahead and just skip because we both agreed I couldn't do it. So
right.
And negative self-talk around math is definitely a challenge.
Yeah. And I mean, I can talk with my students that have been struggling and failing and are desperately trying to recover about, you know, like, you've done this, you've shown that you can do it. You've done this, you know what you're doing. You've done this example with me. You've done this project. All I need you to do is jump in and take this one out. And it's like, boom, all of a sudden one thing happens. They're like, oh my gosh, I'm so stupid. I forgot to do blah, 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 blah. Or I lost a negative. Like, I'm just the worst at math. I'm like, yo, you lost a negative. I do that on the board in front of you at least 3-4 times a week. Like, but it's this little thing that all of a sudden turns into this, like, and it grabs like all the past issues. You stack the negative and it's like game over.
Well, I'm wondering, hearing you tell that story of, like, to me, a kid being able to identify that they lost the negative is proof of concept in terms of, like, no, you actually know the content.
I'm right? going to say that I was probably the one that identified they lost the negative.
Because, okay. Well, I was just thinking about, like, I was wondering, the question I was going to ask on the back end of that statement was, how much in what you've learned about the power of negative self-talk is just changing the way that we think of something as a negative versus, like, it just being part of the process?
Right. And I think a lot of that is the idea of just what is learning and the failure and all this stuff that we've talked about, right? And changing our language. Gosh, that is, like, if you want to talk about changing your ability to learn in a moment, like going from, like, a state of mind where you're not going to let anything in your brain to, okay, I'm actually in a space where I can absorb information. Like, changing our language is critical.
Yeah. And I just think, like, changing it, like, even that little thing of, like, instead of saying you're going to fail a lot, it's like, yeah, you're going to have a lot of attempts that don't get to the spot that you want to, in order to, like, that's a learning experience, and even taking the word failure out of there so that we can't call it. And I'm reminded of, like, one of the big language shifts that I made. One of the things that I learned this from another coach, like, 4 years ago. I know I keep circling back to football lately, but, I used to not do enough of, like, asking my kids. Like, I would do too much of, like, the telling them what they did wrong. Like, hey, like, you should have thrown it here because of this, right? And so I started a shift based on going to a clinic and hearing another coach talk about, don't give the kid the answer, right? Just, like, ask them, why did you do that, right? Or how come?
What was your thought process?
Yeah, what was your thought process?
Decision, yeah.
Yeah, and so that was, like, really helpful. But I found from working with my players that even, like, the way you frame that question can create, like, a sense of, like, trepidation would be the best term that I could use, right? So I was kind of defaulting to the, like, why did you do that? And for whatever reason, kids just heard that as, like, you screwed up. Why did you do that? Right? Even if it was, and I was doing it literally after every single rep in practice. Like, whenever they had a choice to make as a quarterback, soon as they were done, I would look at them and be like, why did you do that? And it was, like, literally no judgment. I told them in advance, like, I'm going to do this. And I could still see, like, the second guessing and the wondering and, like, the trying to legitimize. And then, like, a year and a half into that process, I started thinking about how to phrase the question. And I shifted it to my last year coaching the quarterbacks. I just shifted the question to, what did you see?
Yeah.
That was it. I just changed the question to, what did you – tell me what you saw. And they would say, oh, well, I saw this kid doing that. Great, that's exactly what I saw. That was exactly the right thing to do. Or, right. Hey, I could see how you saw that, but, you know, this is what I saw. And then kind of coming up with some language around, I'm getting too much into the weeds of coaching, but just, like, the shift in language of, what'd you see? Or how did you interpret? Or how did you interpret the passage? What does this quote mean to you, right? And then no judgment in that, and then you can actually get some progress moving, so.
No, I think that's brilliant. It's to go back to our red pen conversation. It's like you took the verbal red pen out of that, you know, grading critique on a verbal, like, why did you do that? And it's like, oh my gosh, my parents just showed up and they're like, why did you do that? You know, it's still there. And so to change to the what did you see is more of a, oh, what was I seeing is like a something I feel like I can answer versus why did I do that? It's like, oh wait, why did I do that? You know, like I think that's such a better question. And I think in math, I'm trying to think where I've gone. Cause I also had like a similar kind of progression in my questioning. Mm-hmm. And it went from the, like, are you sure? Or, you know, like I found myself like anytime like they would give me an answer and it was supposed to be a negative, I would say positive or negative. And they'd be like, negative? You know, like, if you ever asked that question, they would be like, it must be negative. And so I started, you know, making sure I would be like positive or negative. And they'd be like, positive, like, why? You know, and so a lot of times I'd get them, what's your next step? Like, that would be kind of, what's your next
that's
step?
Good. Yeah, or, I like that.
Where do we go next? Mm-hmm. And then usually my follow-up is just, why? You know, and not the why did you do that, but more just the like, okay, where do we go next? Perfect. Why? Or what led you to that thought process? Or, you know, like, and try to have them describe what they saw, what they were feeding off of to guide them. And so it's like getting them to do some of that reflection work verbally. Mm-hmm. And I think that's such a good thing in helping them build the confidence, like we talked about on Tuesday. And building the scaffolding to those next levels.
Well, and I do want to circle back to your comment about like the stuff that you learned about how self-talk is more harmful than positive talk is helpful, or like the
right.
the dichotomy between those two things, because that's a new concept for me. It makes total sense upon hearing you just even describe it. But the thing that I'm wondering about within that reflection thing that you're talking about, like the other thing that I'm wondering, and I don't think either one of us will have the answer because we're not 17-year-old kids anymore. But there's just such a like a low stakes. Okay, this is how the process works, right? Like it's not, there's no judgment in it. There's no, you did it wrong. Just like explaining, this is how I arrived at this place takes the negative out of it, right? Because it's not, why did you do it that way? You're wrong. How come you didn't do it this way? It's just like, hey, let's think through our process here and figure out where we're at. And I think taking that negative framing out of it can help get rid of some of that negative self-talk.
Right. And I think just to kind of get everybody just their own little moment here to do a reflection, like think about a time where you in, you know, athletics, academics, music, arts, whatever it is that like your passion is behind, where you did like 5, 6, 7, 10, 15 things beautifully. And then all of a sudden, like back-to-back things happened that went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
What happened in your mind to those 15 things that were positive? Gone in an instant, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, maybe you have a slightly different experience, but I know for me at least, like those two negatives, especially if they happen back to back, so I stack them. It's like this one counted as 1 point, this one counted as 4 points. You know, like all of a sudden, just bam! It just all of a sudden, everything just got wiped, and those 4 points wipe out 15 points in a heartbeat. Like they're not a 1-to-1 ratio. And I'm trying to remember what the actual ratio I heard on the it was a podcast or a YouTube, one of the two, but they were talking about how it's like 3 to 5 times the impact having negative self-talk compared to positive. So, you know, we can promote positive self-talk. Like I'm a big proponent of, we should change our language. We should growth mindset. We should mm-hmm. be, I can believe it. I can manifest it. Like it's possible. I'm capable, all that kind of stuff. But if I'm doing, I'm capable, I'm positive, I'm worthy of it, I'm attracting this in my life, if I'm doing all of that, and at the same time, I'm like, gosh, I'm so useless. Why do I always make this mistake? Why does this always happen to me? Why does life hate me? Why does, you know, this person hate me? Why are they out to get me? If that exists, even at a third of the level of my positive self-talk, I'm working in the negative. I'm not making any sort of progress.
Yeah, I mean, I'm using negative self-talk as we speak here. Actually, I just kind of that, but I'm thinking about like you asked us to reflect. And one of the things I was thinking about while trying to listen is I always do end of the year survey, which includes like feedback for me, right? Like and pretty open-ended questions. And I was thinking about the fact that I can read 20 plus positive comments in a row and one negative comment. Like I've immediately forgotten everything that was said before that and like focusing in on either getting defensive around why is this person wrong for saying that, and or like thinking about, do I need to reorganize the way my entire classroom works because this one kid was like had this one comment that was negative. And that's literally, you know, let's say like in an average year, 150 students giving feedback, you know, you're going to get some that basically don't give you anything of, you know, anything on either side, right? Neutral feedback, right, or no feedback. And then like, let's say like 100 positive comments and like 15 total negative comments.
Right.
And all I can think about are the 15.
Right. 1-6 ratio. What you just described there, right? Like 6 times as many people like, I love your class. You helped me. I learned. 15 are like, dude, like this wasn't for me. Like you're whack. And you're like, oh, worst teacher. So, no, and it, like, it's so true. And like to go a little bit deeper on this, because this is where it started to land for me, and I became very conscious of it for my students, especially my students that I knew already had a lot going on, like emotionally, like mentally, and they were already living in that negative space a lot. Like when they start to live in that space where all they see is the negative, no matter how much positive is in their life, like it becomes a habit. Like that's a scary place to be. And I remember I was watching the Netflix documentary on Taylor Swift, and there was a part in there where she was talking about how she was so focused on her social media and the likes and the YouTube comments. And she didn't care that she literally had millions of people who loved and adored her, but like these 1,000 trolls that were just out to wreck people's lives, no matter who they were. Like they don't even know her personally, and you don't have to like her music, right? Like that's fine. Like we all have that ability to like or dislike things, but like she just lived in the space of like a 1-1,000 ratio even. And that negativity ripped her from any joy, any feeling of fulfillment. You know, and like it put her in a very dark space. And like that, I think very real for a lot of us. Cause I've seen some of my fellow teacher colleagues all of a sudden like spiral into like, I'm a terrible teacher. I shouldn't be in this field, to my students that are like, I should drop out. Like the world's better without me. And like, those are very scary thoughts, and they're very real. And so why I became so passionate around this idea of eliminating negative self-talk more than promoting the positive is I have felt successful in getting a student to no longer say I suck at math, or to say that I'm no good at school, or I'm a failure, right? Like rephrasing it from I failed this activity to I am a failure, right? Like that identity piece, and going to I'm trying, or I'm doing my best, or I'm going to try this next time, or like very neutral language, and how much improvement that shows. Like it's hard for me to take a kid from the bottom to, hey, I'm very strong, I'm very confident, like I'm a great mathematician, right? But I can pull them from negative to neutral, and like it's amazing how much better they perform because of how much power is associated in that negative, and how much we just shut down and we don't even try because we don't believe we can, right? And I'm not going to get the quote of credit to who it is, right? But that idea of the person who thinks they can and the person who thinks they can't are both right.
Yeah, I remember.
But I want you to say the person who thinks they can't are going to be more right more often.
Yes, okay, that makes sense. Yeah, I remember, I think it was Mr. Corning had that quote up above his door.
Yeah.
In his classroom, whether you think you can or you can't, you are right. Yeah. So, you know, I've put a lot of energy, like you have talked about, like the positive self-talk and the growth mindset component of this. I haven't spent as much time thinking about strategies to like actively try and eliminate negative self-talk. So what are some strategies that you have found some success with in your own experience?
You know, one-on-one conversations is definitely a success for me. That goes back to all the things we talk about in this podcast, right? Like get to know your students, understand their strengths, build upon their strengths to get them back to neutral. We talked about this on Tuesday about the warm-up activity, like feed them like success and then call them very intentionally so they can contribute to the class and build upon that. And so they at least get away from the I'm good at math you know, to the I can do math or I math. You know, mm-hmm. At least it's not the I suck at math, right?
Yeah. So
I think the more we can get them to experience success, the more we can get them to at least change the language, right? The internal self-talk is something that's very difficult to change. It's something the student has to want to do. And I think this is another thing for us as teachers to be aware of, right? Is there's only so much we can do, right? Mm-hmm. And not to let outside things that we can't control impact how we believe we are doing as teachers as well. Like, not to take it personal, right? Like, I forget which agreement it is, but the book, The Four Agreements, it's a super easy, short read. I read it a few months ago. It's been sitting on my shelf for like a year or two, but it's brilliant, right? It's got these super short things in it. And one of the agreements, I think it's the second or third one, is don't take life personally. Mm-hmm. And so like today I had a pizza party for my kids that performed the best on their statistics project we've done the last 2-3 weeks. And half of them didn't show up, even though they were pumped to come to the pizza. They've been talking about it for like 3-4 days. They were stoked about it. They didn't show up. And then I was like, why weren't you there? They're like, oh, that was today. I was like, oh, they didn't remember free food for a party that they were pumped about that they earned. I'm not going to take it personally that they didn't turn in my assignment. You know, like, it was just another one of those reminders that is like, this isn't personal. Right. Like they're not out to be like, Freeberg, I hate your class. I'm not doing your homework. Or, yeah. You know, it's like, this is not to take it personal. But if we can eliminate by building on the things you shared with us on Tuesday, I think that helps a lot.
Okay. So another question that's kind of surfaced for me with this, I'm wondering about how the negativity, and I'm going to translate this to the classroom in a moment. So just kind of bear with me on the metaphor here, right? We hear about trophy culture, right? And everybody gets a trophy and how like we actually have done, we being like the collectiveness of humanity, obviously not you or I, but people have done studies that show that actually the team that comes in last place and gets a trophy actually feels worse because they get the trophy, right? Like it actually harms, it does more harm to that group of kids to give them a trophy, right, than it does to just not give them a trophy,
right,
according to a couple of studies that I've heard and or have had referenced in other things I've been reading. And so I'm thinking about this again in the idea of, you know, I'm a systematic thinker, so I'm going to keep thinking back to like changing the way school works. Have you noticed or did you hear anything in the work that you were doing about like how does moving a kid who knows that they didn't really do what was necessary to pass a class, but they get moved to the 10th grade anyways, and then they get moved to the 11th grade anyways. Do you have any idea, like, if there's anything around, like, the amount of harm that that's actually doing to the confidence of a student if they know that they're just being passed to the next class, even though they don't think they did what was necessary to do that?
I'm not going to be able to give you like research or statistics. I mean, yeah. I can share my experience because I have several students that are that way, especially in math, because, you know, we do everything and anything we can to get them to a 60 and we move them to the next level and they they literally don't know at least 40% of the content according to our 0 to 10 grade scale, which is how most math teachers I know still grade. And they know they don't know that, and they go in with this mindset of, I'm no good at math, so that's negative. Mm-hmm. I barely passed. I probably shouldn't be here, right? And so they know it. They try to be quiet. If they can be quiet, they end up just hiding and disappearing until all of a sudden, crap, they're at a 30% again, right? And they never raise their hand. For me, my experience in math, they will never raise their hand. I have to go over and be like, yo, can I help you? Like, no, I'm good. I'm good. I'm like, you've got a 30 in my class and I give you 40% if you just attempt it, which means you're not even attempting things right now. So I need you to like, let me help you. And I don't know, this might be my own issues too, but like, I don't like just forcing myself on people. So I'm like, I'm going to ask if you want help, because I need you to ask for it. Cause like, I don't know if it's subconsciously, I'm trying to have them practice asking for help. Cause they don't like ever, but like, like I won't just show up and do it for them, you know? Like I'm like, hey, do you need help? And I'm expecting them to say yes. Can you please help me? And then if they're like, well, I don't know, maybe, I'm like, okay, what doesn't make sense? Usually the default is everything, right? And I won't help everything. So I'm like, okay, I get maybe everything feels confusing. What was the last thing that you struggled with? Let's focus on that, right? And I try to get them to refocus on one. And for me, that's the overwhelm. And I think if I were to pick something, I don't have research on this, but if I were to pick something that has massively impacted them long-term on this, just getting passed along, is I don't understand eighth grade math. Now I don't understand ninth grade math. Now I don't understand geometry, right? Sophomore year with me, how the heck am I going to figure out algebra 2 if I don't understand 3 years of math and it's overwhelming? And so for me, when I get a kid in geometry that literally has failed the last 3 years and we've just kind of pushed them through the system, is what do you know? Okay, let's start there, right? And it's the leveling ideas that we've been discussing. And what was the last thing that made sense? Okay, based on that, what do you think we can use to do this? And like, and make it a very small piece. I'm not gonna, you know, to go back to your analogy from Tuesday, I'm not gonna put a brand new play in front of them and go full speed 11 on 11. I'm gonna break it down and say, okay, what did you understand? Okay, let's do that. Okay, see this part? What if I did this? Would this overwhelm you? If the answer is yes, we slow back down, we do another one. Okay, if I do this, does it make sense as to why that happened? Oh yeah, I see where that's coming from. Okay, cool. What would you do now as your first step? Okay, I would do this. Great, now what does it look like? Oh, I already know how to do this, right? And so it's that adding layers on layers. And so I think if I were to pick anything, the shuffling through is creating this overwhelm, because our belief is I didn't pass this. I have no idea what's going on and I'm not going to even try.
Well, and I wonder, you know, not being a math person and not teaching math, but I'm assuming there's a parallel with the humanities, English and social studies, right? What happens to a kid like that is that part of the expectation that the teachers walk into the room with, that we have to check ourselves on from time to time, and we have some strategies that we can use to overcome this, but like we have an assumption that kids can read at a particular grade level, right?
Yeah.
So like, oh, okay, so I'm teaching 10th graders this year. I assume that they can read something with this Lexile score. Well, if the kid has kind of just been pushed along the process, but the last time they felt confident reading was sixth grade, or the last time they felt confident reading was never.
Right.
They've still been pushed into this process. All you've done is put them into a place where the work is actually getting harder to do because they literally can't do the first step.
Right.
Right. Because like the teacher is using more advanced language in the daily instruction and direct instruction element of the class, the language that is being put in front of you in a reading packet or whatever or in a video is more advanced than you're prepared to be able to work with for whatever reason. Maybe there's English language learner barrier to overcome, or just you've got things going on from a learning standpoint that are making it difficult. And there's things that we can do, right? Like as a social studies teacher, I can be very intentional about grabbing and maybe this is a resource that we should share in a future episode, like grabbing, like Newzella is a really great resource, right? Because you can actually pick the grade level that you want to create it at. And then it like gives you the exact same source, but it changes like the font size and the spacing and the language to fit sixth grade, ninth grade, whatever. And then you can kind of create leveled readings for the kids, and you can kind of intentionally like slip a kid the pink packet versus the green packet or whatever, like you were talking about with Whitmer and the different color. I would imagine that's harder to do at the math level though, right?
It's doable though, right? Like you just referenced a guy who did it perfectly. Like it's definitely doable.
yeah, but he can't do that for a kid who walks in and doesn't know how to do multiplication and he's supposed to be doing geometry. Like you can't.
He can. It's just overwhelming, right? Okay. And as teachers, we get overwhelmed and we usually don't do it. Like I'll put myself as an example. If I get a student in my class that doesn't understand the basics, I teach them how to use a calculator. And then I teach them the concept and how to put it in the calculator. Okay. And so like my kid that doesn't know how to do multiplication or is still trying to count on their fingers and is ineffective at even doing that, I teach them a tool because that makes them feel more up to speed. And because once they learn the tool, their speed on the calculator is almost as good as somebody who is quick with their times tables or, you know, mental math addition stuff, right? And now they feel at least up to speed, even though their foundation is still way off base. Mm-hmm. From like the specific skill, so to speak.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't know, man, like ultimately you can build a classroom that is at 20 different levels, but I'm teaching 20 different kids at 20 different speeds. And if you've ever tried to do it at three different levels, you know, it's overwhelming. 20 would make all of us go insane and we don't get paid enough to do that. So I ain't going to do it. I hate to say that, but like, we as teachers get paid to do a very specific job, and the expectation with the scaffolding and the diversification of learning, yeah, and the you know, repetitive and the where did we start, where did we get to, hit all the standards, teach all the soft score, like you don't pay us enough to do that.
Well, for me, it's not even about the pay. I mean, that's a legitimate question. We do get summers off, which I love. Like, the thing that I think about, like when you're thinking about like, okay, I've got 24 different students in here. One of them needs to learn how to read. The other one needs to learn how to do college level research papers. And I've got everything in the middle.
Yeah.
To me, it's not a question of pay. It's a question of legitimately serving the needs of all of that range, right? Like I, for one, don't have the bandwidth to do that. Like, I just know that, like, I, like, again, using the sports analogy, I don't have the bandwidth on the same practice field working towards the same Friday night deadline to get a sixth grade level football player and a 12th grade level football player to be like feeling like they're growing and learning in a way that's valuable. It's not even about whether or not the sixth grader is going to be ready for Friday night, because the answer to that is obvious. No, he's not ready. The problem is, how do I even give that kid a valuable experience that they're going to feel like they don't need to have negative self-talk, like they're getting something out of it and wanting to come back, and also providing that to the upper tier kid. And this is where tracking comes in, right? But we also know that tracking is extremely harmful to kids. And so I don't know how to uncrack this bottle, but I or whatever the appropriate metaphor there is, but I'd push back a little bit on, and I know you didn't mean it this way, but like, it's not because we don't get paid enough. It's because it's literally not possible to do all of those things well.
Correct.
And you could pay me $1 million to do it.
Eventually get really good at it. It's because I put in 60, 70 hour weeks, end on end on end on end, and you paid me for 37. That's where I'm coming at it. For me to do a job of six teachers and you pay me for one, that's what I'm arguing, right?
Yeah, and I my yes and to that would be, even if you paid me $1 million a year, if you put 45 students in my classroom and they all needed their own individual lesson each day, every day for 90 minutes a year, like I could not meet, it doesn't matter how much you pay me, I could not meet those needs.
However,
every single day. However, for $1 million, I will try longer.
However, with $1 million, you've got enough resources to get a team around you that can do it. Right. Like, okay, you get to a certain amount where all of a sudden now, you know, like in my classrooms with my ESL students, you know, we have a smaller class size with multiple aides in my classroom because we're trying to help them get to the next level. And I do have students in that group that, one, can't speak English, two, haven't done math since the third grade because they're refugee students, mm-hmm, you know, like. And you're overcoming that with a student who transferred from the top of their class but can't speak English very well. Mm-hmm. And so they're in the same dynamic. This kid feels stupid and won't give you any of the effort. This kid feels bored. It's like, what do I do? You know? So yeah. And to get that negative self-talk, I unfortunately will tend to push the upper level kid and try to hope like crazy they at least hang onto the rope as I'm yanking the bottom. You know, like, I'm like, hey, you're coming with me, just hold on, let's go, you know? And like, I hope you're going to pull something out of this, because I'm going to show you some cool things, it might be beyond your comprehension level, and I'm going to come back and try to help like piece some of it together. But I don't know, for me, that's where I've chosen to spend my energy, is to push my upper level and hope that, you know, like when the tide rises, all the boats rise, right? Like I'm hoping I'm going to bring everybody with me if I stay at a high level. And I think I do a decent job of that. I think
you're not relying on just hope, right? You've got strategies that you're using to give those kids a chance to keep up. So it's not like you're only teaching five kids and hoping that the other 10 are learning by osmosis. So it's not pure hope on your part. So I want to give you some credit for how you're doing. And again, like I know I derailed us with the system talk there, but like the system has set you up to be in that position, and there's no good way to solve that without. Yeah, if you give me $1 million and I use half of it to pay four other people to help me get to the end line, right? Like, sure, game on. But
those four people are going to be able to create beautiful content for all those levels of learning. And then I can come in and be a Whitmore that has excellent content, and I can just coach, you know, at all levels, because I can handle those levels. I just can't handle getting all the resources that help properly guide them. And then, again, to your point, if you spread us thin enough, I'm getting 20 kids at 20 different levels. Each kid is literally going to get 3 minutes a day of my attention for an hour class.
Yeah. So knowing in advance a little bit some of the other strategies that you talked about for like moving on from negative self-talk, I have created kind of a negative feedback loop here where we're talking about something that we don't have a lot of control over. One of the things that you talked about is movement, right? Like the idea of like literally moving out of the space where the negative self-talk is happening. What are some other like kind of default strategies that you've learned for just like kind of creating that like cut, move to the next thing,
right? With
the negative self-talk.
So if I think about some of my students and even my own experience a bit, when I get into a negative self-talk loop, right? I'm in a negative spiral. The thing that needs to happen for me is I need to break it, right? Mm-hmm. Like it needs to get cut off, and I need to get out of it. Full disclosure, this is the one and only time I will swear in the presence of a child. and it's a one-on-one conversation. It's very quiet. And it's when they are in a state where they hate whatever's going on and they cannot get out of it. And I'm like, you know what? You're right. That is complete BS, right? But I'll say it. And that, dude, if you have not cursed all year and you say something in front of a student in a very meaningful, impactful way, it breaks them. It gets them to a different spot, and it has to be very strategic. And I've never been called to my principal's office for using it. and again, it's not a public thing. It's not in front of my class. It's a very individual, very quiet. And it's usually with a kid who's been dropping F-bombs in my class all year anyways. And so it's enough of a shock factor that it breaks them from their current thought patterning. Mm-hmm. And it's almost a connection piece, because they're like, oh, he's going to relate with me. Okay, let's go, you know? But you have to break it. And so, yeah, there's three primary ways that I've experienced to break those. And the first you talked about is physical movement, right? Like if we get our body moving, like it goes from one to the next. Like if I'm pissed off and I need to get out of a state of mind, I'll go for a run, right? Mm-hmm. Or I'll go play basketball or volleyball. Or I'll go like hit, you know, like punch a pillow, right? Punch something soft. it punches back. If any of our high school boys are listening to this, do not punch a wall. You will break your hand. I've seen lots of my friends do it. You know, but find those ways, find those ways to get that energy, that stuckness to just move through you, right? Like your body, your physical movement's one way to do it. The other is to shift your focus. If all I'm focused on is all the crap that's going wrong, all I'm going to see is all the crap that's going wrong, right? Mm-hmm. And I know we've done this before, but you know, if you were to close your eyes, or if you were to look around the room first and look for all the things that are the color green, and you focus on finding all the things green, I tell you to close your eyes and I say, what are all the things in your room that are the color blue? You're not going to see as many things in your mind with your eyes closed that are blue as what was actually there, because you weren't focused on it. Then I say, okay, open your eyes, look for things that are blue. You're going to see more things that are blue. So if we can shift our focus from all the crap that is wrong to all the things in our life that we're grateful for, that it's a massive 180, right? If you can at least go to a spot where you focus on the things that you can control instead of being stuck on the things that you're out of control with, if you can change your focus to what you did right instead of all the things you did wrong, if you can put focus on when you accomplished something versus all the times you failed, right? Like the shift of focus breaks that pattern. Okay. And then we talked about the language earlier today too, but that would be the third big idea for helping us break that negative self loop, that spiral is, yeah, I got to change my language and go back to either like a growth mindset or an attitude of gratitude or, you know, whatever it is to help us shift it up.
So I'm sure you have some strategies. I will share. I didn't have like this kind of framework to work with that you've got, but I know like two things that work really well for me that relate to those. And they're almost kind of one and the same. Is like, if I'm getting to a point where I'm realizing that I'm just like uber frustrated and I'm like seeing the color red is the phrase, right? I just I'm ready to punch a wall.
Right.
And I was showing my knuckle to those of you. I played soccer in a game and got really upset and split my knuckle on a goalpost because I gave up a goal. So to T-Free's point, don't punch things that hurt more than you'll hurt them.
Physics, baby.
And don't hit people.
Yeah.
Or anything that's alive.
yes, please.
Don't hit your dog either, right?
Hit a pillow. Inanimate, yeah. Soft objects.
Beautiful. Yeah. For me, it's like getting up and like physically getting out of the space, right? So it's not necessarily like the movement itself for me. But when I think of the movement, it's like, okay, like if I'm working, like we joked about the IKEA project a couple of episodes ago, right? Like for me, like if I'm doing the IKEA project in the living room, I need to go to the bedroom. I'll go take a shower. I'll go for a walk. But for me, at least the way I think about it, it's not the walk that's helpful. It's just like getting myself some space from the thing. And then from like a shifting my focus, it kind of goes into that same thought process of how do I shift my focus? It's, well, I'm going to get out of this space. Like, but the thing that I struggle with the most for both of those is, how quickly can I recognize that I'm either headed down that path or I've already gone halfway up the mountain and I need to get back at some point. So I'm wondering when you're talking about shifting the focus or for any of these strategies that you're talking about, or like the key element is recognizing that you're in that space in the first place, right?
Right. And a great way to just build a pattern to get you out of it, because I'm a huge believer of energy, and I think removing yourself from the space of frustration is powerful because it removes you from the negative energy that has been created, period, right? Mm-hmm. So hallway conversations, right? Like we move into the hallway. The IKEA project, we move to a different room. You've held a lot at work today because you were holding space for kids that were going through traumatic crap, or you were holding space for your frustrated coworker that's struggling with their students and their spouse or whatever it is, right? Mm-hmm. And you're carrying this because you showed up as a really good human. You got to go take that shower and physically rinse all that crap off of you because it's there. Like I'm a firm believer of that. With all of us stuck at home and all of this computer and COVID and all this stuff, right? You've got to set like a 45-minute timer and physically get up, move, walk around, change your element, change your space on a regular basis, even if it's 3, 4, 5 minutes. Like no matter what you're doing, if you're in the middle of a project, like hit that timer, get up, shift it a little bit, right? You got to move, because if you get stuck in a spot, especially if you're having like a writer's block where you're in a creative, dead zone, like you've got to change the space. You got to change the energy. And I think for multiple reasons, but that's a good strategy. I think everybody should take with them is set their timer for 45 minutes. I make my students do this when we were virtual. I was like, set your timers for 45 minutes. If you have worked on my homework assignment for more than 45 minutes, walk away from my assignment. Go, take the trash out, go get a glass of water, go play with the dogs, go, scroll through Instagram for 5 minutes, then turn your phone off and keep it out of reach again, right? Because I don't want it to be a distraction while you're in the moment. Mm-hmm. But I do need you to shift it every 45 minutes.
Okay. Is the 45 minutes, like, is that something, like, is that just like a random time, or did you come up with that from somewhere?
I heard it on a podcast between, I think, 45 minutes to an hour, somewhere in there. I have a shorter attention span. So I'm like, I'm going to go on the short end of that. So,
yeah.
I mean, there's moments where I'll sit still for an hour and a half. You know, sometimes you and I get in that, you know, great conversations here and we've been sitting for an hour and a half. But the first thing I do as soon as I'm done here is not to go then upload the podcast, make the cuts, get the music in, right? Like I get up, I physically shift, I take the dogs out. Like I got to get out of this space before I go back into a creative mindset. So
that makes sense. That's a tip I'll use for myself, at least. I think that's a good one.
It doesn't be long, right? It's just maybe even, you know, for us that are more physical and we like that energy movement, it's at 45 minutes, I get off of whatever chair I'm at. I do like 3 squats, 3 push-ups, a couple of crunches, drink some water, and I get back to work, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it can be quick. It's just you have to break the pattern. You got to get from one space to the next to keep yourself alive.
So. Yes. Especially during the pandemic, as you said, right? Like, and get trapped sitting in these chairs for a long time. So,
right.
All right, folks, before Tim starts with his story time, just wanted to remind you that at littlebiged.com, we are available for our free resources. This week, I'll be putting up an example of how to find those components within a larger skill set that you can break things down as to kind of give you an example or a template to work off of in your own classrooms. And you can always still rate and review us on littlebiged.com. Little Big Things Education podcast can be found Spotify, Google, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, anywhere you find podcasts, we are available. So go ahead and rate and review us, and we'll get back to Tim's story.
Right. Well, I'd love to close this with some story time. We kind of talked a little bit about some of the stuff I've already been doing, but for me, when I think about negative self-talk, I think about how quickly I used to crumble in high school and how that pattern took me a long time to work away from and how quickly I can still crumble if I get lazy on my work. Right. Mm-hmm. So like, I don't know, like I guess at this point I can probably toot my own horn. Like, I was a pretty good student. I was a pretty good athlete, you know, and I just never thought I was good enough. And for whatever reason, like, that was in my head. And so I would do something good. I'd make a good block. I'd make a good tackle. I'd make a good read. I'd, you know, make a good shot. I'd, you know, whatever, it would get a good score on a test. And like, in that moment, I'm like, great, what's next? Great, what's next? And then as soon as there was the failure moment, I'm like, gosh, I knew I was going to fail. I knew I was going to fail. And even if it has been a month since I failed, I knew it was coming, right? Like, I prophesized this and I knew it. And so I would stack a loss on top of a loss on top of a loss. And then by the time I'm in college, you know, I have all of these years of high school losses stacked. So every time I fail in college, you know, and I've talked about this a little bit too, right? Like, I would just go and drink it away and I would forget about it. Right. Mm-hmm. And the thing I eventually learned about drinking is if I ignore stuff, it's still there when I wake up and sober up. And so I haven't done any of the work to make it any better. It's still there. And it continued to stack. And so for me, what I really would like to put forward for people is this idea of, if you can stay at least neutral and be comfortable with being average at moments, I think, I don't know if that's the right phrase I want to go with, but if the more I've been comfortable with just being present, and I didn't need to be outstanding, I didn't need to be the spotlight, I was there, I was doing stuff, I was present, and I was showing up. The more comfortable I was, like, acknowledging that part of my life existed, and instead of, oh, I'm always going to fail. Yeah, I am always going to fail. Like, that's part of growth. We've talked about that, but changing my language, changing my meaning behind that has been huge. And then being able to just be present has been a great part. And so I think that's when I started to hear this about, like, 3 to 5 times more impactful having negative self-talk versus positive self-talk. I'm like, oh, I just need to get really good at being neutral. And so the more I've been able to do that, the better. And so, like, I shared, you know, kind of early on. Now, where I end up now, like if I'm playing co-ed volleyball or something, right? And I go and I get a great kill and then another great kill and a good dig. And then I get blocked. I'm like, crap. You know, like, I can't believe I just got blocked. Like, I just lost a point for us. Like, I mentally, I already forgot that I scored 3 points or whatever, right? But then for me, again, where this happens and almost pulls me out of the game for a play or two before I'm like, yo, refocus, reshift, you know, is if it happens twice in a row, right? Like, if you compound something, game over. And I see this with my students. I saw this in softball the other night when I was DJing. Like, I watched the catcher, you know, miss a ball, kid scored. Next play, you know, bunt, catcher picks up the ball, airmails it in the left field, misses the first baseman. Like, literally was out of her element for the next, like, two innings. You could just see it in the body language, all of it. And so for me, if I was going to try to put like another like red flag trigger for me on like trying to help me get out of this pattern, I need a movement. I need a sound. I need something where when two things go wrong, I need to do this because I know I'm spiraled and what's going to happen for the next however long it takes me to get out of it. It's going to take much longer than if I have something that reminds me, oh, you just had two errors. You got to shift your thinking now. So for me, that's been my awareness piece is like when I know two things go wrong, I'm like, okay, I got to go back to neutral. And it's really hard to get me to go positive, but I'm at least better at getting from a negative spiral where it's going to be a mess for a while back to at least neutral because I know how impactful that negative self-talk is. So I think, if I were to leave a takeaway for people, it would be one, don't let things stack, especially over years. That creates a massive issue and it can lead to a lot of like the addictive behaviors and the numbing out into the avoidance and all the stuff we've talked about. And I know we see in our students. So please have those like vulnerable, honest conversations with your students when you see that happening, because it happens in all of our classrooms. I truly believe that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's just hard to see. Because they're really good at covering it. And with perfectionism too, that's sometimes where they'll cover a lot of that mm-hmm. hurt, that pain. because if I'm perfect, then I don't have to worry about that time I messed up. But as soon as I mess up, it ruins my identity because I'm a perfectionist, right? Mm-hmm. So try to avoid stacking, at all costs. And when stacking occurs, get back to neutral as fast as possible. So.
I love that. I like the idea of getting back to neutral, and I'm glad that you found some strategies that are working both for you and your students. So thanks for sharing that.
You're welcome. All right, everybody. We'll see you next week. Always learn at Peak State.
Make it a great day.